Welcome to the On Coaching Podcast. I'm Steve Magnus, joined as always by my good friend and colleague, Jonathan Marcus. John, what's going on, my man?
Hey, we're sticking around. We're coming back around. We're doing what we do. Why? Because we just can't stop and we won't stop. We're giving the people what they want. Let's go.
You know, that's very apt before you break out into song lyrics there on Can't Stop, Won't Stop. It's very apt for today's topic, which is the science of drive, how to get better and become the best. So we're going to talk about why we keep showing up, but more importantly, how to get your athletes to keep showing up and to get buy-in and persistence and all of those things that are difference makers. But before we head there, you know, John, the place that we show up the most consistently at the highest quality, it's the Scholar Program.
Oh, it is. Baby, let's go. If you haven't signed up right now, ASAP. It is a must.
That's right. We've got all sorts of courses. We've got, you know, interviews. We've got the Mike Smith tapes. We've got the mother of all Renato Canova files, everything possible. We've got the new biomechanics course based on Tom Telez's work. We've got the Igloi course. We've got, even for beginners, we've got, you know, walking you through a marathon season or a high school cross country season. We've got it all from beginner to expert, for coaches, for runners. We just throw it in there. Actually, I was talking to a scholar the other day, or a new scholar, who was just like, holy crap. Like, I signed up and I'm just overwhelmed by the amount of quality information. They're like, I don't even know where to start. And I just said, you know, the beauty of this is you can take courses on specific things. So if you've got a specific problem, but more so, I said, follow your interest, man. Treat it like the library of candy and just go deep. And I promise you, you're going to get lots of value. And they were overwhelmed. And it was kind of cool to see, because I don't think there's any other place like that on the internet.
Yeah. I mean, basically, if you got a problem, there's potentially a high potential that there's a solution or several solutions available to you, not only in the course material, but also in the chatter in the clubhouse. And at first pass, yes, it can be totally overwhelming. It's a whole buffet and smorgasbord of things. But if you just follow, like Steve said, your interests and say, hey, I'm interested in learning more about this, or I realize I have this educational awareness gap here, or I'm not sure about this there. Boom. You know, that's the best way to pursue it. I tell people all the time. Some people come in wanting to learn about wickets. Some people come want more about flux trading. Some people want to come learn about, you know, culture and buy-in, or, you know, the marathon training or what have you, or just see examples of what Canova does to inspire their own kind of work. Any starting point is a good starting point, but the most important thing is that you start. The most important thing is to sign up, give it a shot. It's less than $1 a day. I mean, excuse me, just over $1 a day now. Sorry, inflation hit. We went crazy and made it a little bit over $1 a day. It's cheap. It's affordable. But the most important thing is it is accessible. And that's why it's at the price point it's at. And that's why we keep hyping it up and encouraging our listeners to join, because, you know, going on almost 700 strong now in that clubhouse, it's just one of those things. 5 years, 10 years from now is going to be a force to reckon with.
And don't forget, you know, one of my favorite parts, John, is the monthly Zoom meetings where, you know, we set out and we said, hey, we're going to talk for an hour to people and nerd out. And I think every single session has gone 90 minutes or longer because we're just coaches nerding out. So, you know, it's one of my favorite parts of the program. If you're in it and haven't checked it out, a Zoom session, you got to sign up. They're fun. Or you got to attend if you're not in. I'm just saying, that's one of the other perks. If you like nerding out with coaches of all levels, man, join in. All right. So let's go into today's topic, the science of drive, how to get better and become the best. So, you know, one of the things here, John, is a lot of times we talk about culture and motivation and how you got to want it and like getting that buy-in with people. And the reason we talk about that so much as coaches is because we realize the importance of it. I've always said that you can have the perfect training plan, but if you don't have buy-in, doesn't matter. It's not going to work. It's going to fail. So today we're going to kind of unpack this science of motivation and drive, and look at things on a deeper net level and kind of nerd out a bit. And I'm going to start with, you know, some very, very basic foundations that kind of orient us. Is that if you look at motivation, we have these two big broad buckets of like intrinsic versus extrinsic. And there's delineations or variations in each. But in general, you have extrinsic, which is what the accolades, the achievements, the rewards. And then you have intrinsic, the joy, the experience, etc. And the key is that in this distinction, we have to realize that we all have motivators that are on both sides of it. Okay. No one is just purely joy built. Maybe, I don't know, some monk who's practiced 10,000 hours of stuff, maybe. But no one is really purely intrinsically motivated. No one is purely extrinsically motivated. There's a hint or there's a mixture of both in here. But what we do know is that if you look at how we get involved in things that are interesting in us, or we're interested in, the pursuits, the passions, the sports, is they almost always start out with some intrinsic component. And all we have to think about is how most likely you got involved in sport, like you, the listener. Did you sign up for, I don't know, Little League baseball or the local soccer league or junior high track out of like, oh man, I want to become the best in this and get $1 million or get a pay date? No, you said, I enjoy sports. I enjoy the camaraderie, maybe, of being on a team. I enjoy these things that bring me like joy and passion of it. And that's generally how we get involved. But what tends to happen over time is that intrinsic kind of gets beaten down a little bit as these extrinsic markers and things come about. So we start winning trophies, we start getting notoriety, we start getting a little status, et cetera, et cetera. And if that goes too far, then what we've gotten is we lose kind of that intrinsic joy, and that's often the... And you see this at the college level. That's often the athlete who's still doing it because why? Because they did it in high school. It's the thing that defines them. It's the thing that they're known as. And that kind of joy of competing has been put by the wayside of like, I'm just going through the motions because like, this is who the external world sees me as, and I'm going to chase X, Y, and Z. And I think this is foundationally why like outlining these two kind of broad dichotomies is so important, because when we talk about buy-in and persistence and all that stuff, is that the extrinsic, I like to think of it as I had a mentor and a professor actually who used this example, who said that the intrinsic is like cooking on coals, right? They just burn for a really long time once they're lit. It's not fancy. It's just, you get heat. The coals take a long time to burn. And the extrinsic is like putting lighter fluid on it. You get a big, big flame, and then it kind of dies out. And if you don't have anything to support that big flame, then you're in trouble. And it's not to say we shouldn't use lighter fluid every once in a while, but if we don't have that underlying support, we're in big trouble. So, all right, I just kind of nerded out on the science of it, but I wanted to set that stage as we get into this, okay, how do we cultivate these things, this drive, this motivation to look at buy-in, persistence, et cetera?
These are all like, very common terms we talk about, right, in the coaching community, and, you know, top of the list being buy-in. How do you get people bought in? And it's such a hard thing to do. And I'm going through that cycle, that buy-in cycle right now with this new program and the athletes on the roster I inherited who, you know, they're not sure. They don't know. It's some new person with a new training philosophy, you know, orientation and shift on how to get prepared and what it means to be a collegiate Division I runner at a mid-major level and blah, 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 blah. So part of it is also just as a coach, understanding from a perspective standpoint where the athletes you're working with are coming from. And that just takes time and dialogue and observation to be able to surmise, because drive is very interesting, at least in my own personal experience as a person and athlete and working with others, is it comes down to conviction. And that it does start from, you know, as Steve said, an intrinsic place. And that is essentially the heartbeat of drive, is this intrinsic motivation or conviction to work towards, achieve, explore, discover, do something that, and challenge yourself for your own, you know, personal development through the context and lens of sport. Then, you know, it's interesting when it's not there. And there's kind of people who are half in, half out, kind of just take it when it's easy and just want everything to be rose colored all the time and smooth and simple. And that low level of conviction or drive ends up, in my experience, being something where it is more like the lighter fluid, in terms of it's like, oh, phew, here you go. We got like a shot of it one day, but then it's totally gone the next day, right? And it's more like newspaper fire versus like big log fire. And that's how I think about it. It's like, how do we get these big logs to burn, especially say in Portland, Oregon, in winter, as Steve knows, in winter training, when it's gray and dark and cold and damp, and you're like, what time is it? It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It feels like it's, you know, sunrise, and it just never gets nice out for a good portion of the winter. How do you keep going? And that's the million-dollar question, right? With all these different solutions and books and courses and things. And at the end of the day, it comes down to me, a personal inventory. I think we don't make enough time for that in this day and age. We're always trying to go and achieve things and demonstrate our achievements and post them and say, hey, look at me. But you got to understand why you're doing what you're doing, and also why you're not doing what you're not doing, if that makes sense. Because it's always going to be about trade-offs. But that personal inventory, taking that time to itemize that and write it down, whether it's once a month, once a season, once a year, is a really healthy activity that can help you discover those intrinsic incentives that you're like, I just want to do this because I want to do this, versus seeing if you're actually more extrinsically motivated by extrinsic rewards or incentives, which are fleeting. And that's the hardest part. The fleeting incentives tend to motivate us for very short periods of time, and it creates a rapid injection of activity, but it doesn't sustain us over the long haul. So we can actually like translate that activity that we are able to demonstrate in spurts into sustained achievement and sustained change and sustained growth.
Exactly. I think that I love this. I think what we're getting around, and this is why I love this kind of dichotomy, is like, it's not that sometimes you don't need those small injections, right? Sometimes you're going to need them, right? But the example I would like to give, or I'd give, is it's like, is like those small injections need to be like timely and like kind of rare, where it's like, okay, this matters. I can get a little extra boost by shifting my focus towards, I don't know, what it means if I win this thing or whatever have you. That's fine. But over the long haul, we need those logs burning. We have to have that foundation. And if you don't, like, those timely injections are just going to burn quickly and burn out. And I think the personal inventory is a great example, because often what happens, and I alluded to this, but there's all sorts of research that shows this, which is, and you alluded to it as well, is that is our motivation tends to shift, often imperceptibly without us being aware. So we start the thing because we enjoy it, right? Because like there's some exploration, to use that phrase, which I love. Like we're discovering, we're on a journey to see how good we could be, to see what this sport is about. But over time, our motivators shift without us kind of being perceptibly aware that they are. And we stop exploring. We start playing it safe. We start becoming risk averse. because like our motivators underlying have shifted. So I think number one, what you're getting at here is one of the most important things is that if we take a regular inventory of what we're doing and what our underlying motivators are, all of a sudden it gives us that ability to pop out of the ocean and see, okay, where am I headed? Where am I at? Where am I going? So I think that's incredibly important. The other thing that I think is also important here is that purpose or that why, that understanding, like what's underneath it all, and keeping that as your kind of North Star, you know, prevents you from going off the ledge a little bit and drifting towards maybe, you know, chasing the fleeting that we often do, especially in today's society.
Yeah. And one of the, you know, most important activities that's also kind of the hardest activity, just because from a time constraint component, is to make space to actually verbalize that and voice it, right? Or write it down in your journal in paper, right? We know the science on writing and quote unquote thinking in ink. It helps things become more concrete and less abstract. Typing it down on your phone or your computer doesn't do the same thing. It doesn't hit the same way, right? Because fundamentally writing or speaking is a much slower process than typing on a keyboard. So in slowing down, you then have to become selective. I'm reminded of a book I read where it's like the most important thing you can do, right, when you are thinking about things or contemplating a decision, is write things down and articulate that on pen to paper, because it's the decision of the language you use that clarifies your thoughts, because the rapidness at which we can think is warp speed. But when we make a decision to write this word on the paper versus that word on the paper, we're now shaping and clarifying actually what's meaningful to us, because that decisiveness is a key part of drive, right? Because that decisiveness, that of conviction, you're fundamentally deciding you want to do something at the cost benefit of doing, of ignoring and not doing all these other things. And that's okay. We need to make decisions and we need to act. Otherwise you're paralyzed, right? Analysis, or the paralysis of analysis, takes hold then if you just don't go and execute. But in order to execute, right, you need to have preemptively a clear compass about what it is you're doing and why it is you're doing. And so people call it like finding your why, but the science on it is really interesting. It's making that regular time to either voice it in peer groups or one-on-one groups with a mentor, and or talk about it to yourself on a piece of paper in your journal. And then it starts to shape and clarify, and it becomes more real and becomes more ingrained, and then it becomes more fluent. And that's the key thing when we talk about the logs versus the newspaper analogy here, is if you're just thinking about it and it kind of pops in your head here and there and just kind of it carries with you, but you forget it because life, you know, starts to be kind of like a riptide and just kind of pulls you in one direction. And then all these like external incentives or status symbols or things you see or are subject to, whether it's on social media or your peer group, starts to pull you away and say, hey, these are the things that matter most. These are the things that people are talking about. These are the things that are getting like publicity. Okay, yeah, I guess these are the things I should index higher on now. But if you've written it down and that conviction is strong, then you're more kind of like a old oak tree in the forest, right? You're not going to get swayed as much by the passing winds of fancy. You're going to know exactly what you're doing, why you're doing, and, you know, still be able to buffer those winds that come and go, but stay on course.
You know, I'm glad you brought this up, and I think it's such an important point. And it's, as you said, the science of it is fascinating and kind of interesting. You know, briefly, like our brain is predictive. So it takes in information to decide, like to kind of make sense of what we think and what we do and all that stuff. And one of the interesting things is when we verbalize it, when we write it, when we make it external out in the world, our brain not only like sees that, it takes that as almost evidence of like, oh, okay. Like I really do believe this or think this or want this, because it's not just in my head. Like I'm seeing it out in the world, just as, you know, similar is if we act and do something consistently that reinforces to our brain that like this matters. So if I get up every day and work out or get out the door and run, like often it becomes it like ingrains that of like, oh, I'm a runner and like this is part of who I am. So I'm going to do this consistently and not need as much like activation energy or motivation to get started here. So I think that's incredibly important. The other thing that I want to highlight that you said is the act of like deciding or choosing. Is there's a lot of good research and all that to back that if we actively choose to do something, if we make the decision, like it's so much more powerful. And I think as coaches, this is important because often, you know, in the old school model of coaching, like we take away some of that decision making, right? We, you know, you're going to do X, Y, and Z because I tell you to. The old school strength coach, like this is it, you're doing this, or the exercise is punishment, blah, blah, blah. All that kind of backfires in the long haul if it's like strict dictatorial, because like the athlete isn't choosing to do it. If you stick people in the situation and they can, again, you kind of create this bias towards like making a choice. But if you do that, like it ingrains that intrinsic motivation and like keeps you sustained over the long haul. And the example I actually like to use is I wrote about this in Do Hard Things, but it's from my wife in teaching, is with elementary school kids and behavior problems, they quickly realize that like if you give kids a choice, like you're freaking out, they're misbehaving, you come up and you give the kids a choice and you say, hey, like we can either like pause and reset right now, or like you can choose to whatever, like sit out recess or go not sit out, but like go over this at recess, which is something they don't want to lose. What do? They choose to pause and sit right, you know, figure it out right now. And what that does is it often helps with that behavior problem because like they're making the decision to do so. And the same thing happens when we make choices as adults, is like if we choose to, you know, pursue the thing, then it gets ingrained as like, oh, I'm pursuing this out of some intrinsic joy or motivation or what have you, which increases that drive to do the thing.
Mm-hmm. And that again, it comes back down to that compass when you have your decision or choice metrics index. And I think as coaches, right, what we can do is provide a little bit of clarity and provide optionality. Like you said in that example with the elementary school kids, Steve, is we can provide optionality and say, well, we can do this and this can be the potential like outcome, or we can do this and that can be the potential highly likely outcome, or you can do this and this is the potential highly likely outcome. And that as a beacon, you know, in the coaching role, it's just shaping the path for the athlete, saying these are the ways forward with these decisions that you will make. And I constantly talk about this a lot to the student athletes at Portland State, is, you know, it's not about one workout, or it's not about the workout, right? Everyone over indexes on that because the media, workout Wednesday, Strava, splits, right? That's what you see. You see a lot of inputs about, oh, did you see that workout? Did you see that workout? Did you see that workout? And I've seen enough workouts in my life to know it's not about the workouts. You know, what it is, it's about how you come in and enter into the workout, and then how you exit and move away and absorb, quote unquote, the workout, right? So we talk about, like, say, the track, we're talking about the oval and the splits and all these wild and crazy things. It's like, no. What was your constitution, mindset, and condition coming into that session? And then what were the tangible actions and steps that you were doing after that session that really helped to set you up for success to absorb and get the most, abstract the most physiological as well as mental benefit from that taxing effort? And that's where most people lose the plot. They will do the workout, hit the split, and think, great, now I can just, you know, turn it off and go do whatever, stay up till 3 a.m. eating Doritos and gummy bears, and it's all good. And, you know, I'll get all the benefit from the workout. And it's having these real conversations and saying, no, staying up till 3 a.m. is actually mitigating or, you know, canceling out all the potential benefit that you could have got from that workout, because we call it the little things colloquially in coaching, but this conviction and this decision-making and this drive isn't there. If you're only driven at the track when it's workout time and you don't have that conviction before and after and leading into it and leading out to it, that's the thing I think that frustrates people the most, because it catches a lot of people off guard. And I think, oh, I did all this hard work and I can look to it. It's very objective and tangible. But now why am I not getting a whole lot better? Or why are my race results still lackluster? And that's where the inventory comes in, is saying, whoa, what about the little things, like the time between the sessions? What's going on here, you know, that is either sustaining or improving you, or is retracting and corroding that effort that you put there on the track on, you know, Tuesday and Friday or whatever it may be.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, John. And I think if we get into the details of how we apply this, I think step one is you have to show your athletes that you care. And then it's not just about you. And I think you can do this a number of ways, your attitude, your mentality. You know, the example that you always give that I think is perfect is, you know, Mike Smith in responding to athletes in their training logs and having that space. What does that send? That sends a message that, like, I care. I'm going to take the time to understand, like, what you're dealing with, what you're struggling with, what you're succeeding at, and to really kind of foster that. I think another idea that, you know, we talk about team building and culture and all that a lot together, but I think the more you can foster a group atmosphere where it's not just that, like, hey, we're on part of this team to do something, but that we're part of this team as like a support group, as a network, as like being bigger than ourselves. And one of the ways that, you know, I always give this example, but I think really worked well at Houston, was creating like small group meetings where we talk about stuff outside of sport to kind of foster, hey, these are our people. This is an environment where I feel secure enough to share. And the more things that we can do to kind of engender and develop that, the better off we are.
Yeah, it's easy to say, but it's tough to do in practice, right? You know, that's time commitments, class schedules for student athletes, life schedules for adult runners. If you're coaching remotely, you know, you're never really in the same place in the same time. I mean, you know, that's the reality. It's the goal of the coach, I think, with regards to helping foster and also develop and grow an athlete's drive, is to be driven themselves and lead by example. And part of that just comes with being dependable and showing up, you know, time after time and doing what you say you're going to do, you know, day in and day out. It's really nothing special, but it goes a long way to just be that steady hand that's at the helm and the wheel, because it just demonstrates to your athletes that you're working with that you're there, you're fully invested, this matters. And, you know, if it matters as much to me that I, you know, live my life and budget my life around all this, you too can take that initiative to make it matter a lot to you as well, because I'll be here to kind of walk the streets with you versus, you know, the coach who's not as, you know, super receptive or inconsistent with communication or knee jerk, you know, reactions and responses to things. Like, you know, a simple way that I demonstrate that is by, once I get to know the athletes I'm working with really well, I tend to like write training in 3 week blocks to 6 weeks blocks, right? So here is the guide for the next 3 to 6 weeks. It's not just week by week, day by day, piecemealed out. You can schedule your life around this. You can say, okay, hey, here's what we're going to do on this day. Here's what we're going to do on that day. And as a guide, right? Variability happens. Life gets in the way. You get sick. You know, things come up. Totally get it. But at the same time, too, it's understanding that being driven enough to take the time to really lay out the what we're going to do on a day-to-day basis for a sustained period of time helps athletes see that vision about what's coming down the pipeline. And I think, again, we go back to a lot of people are, oh, I'm a visual learner, but it kind of sets it in stone, right? And the other thing you can do to help foster that conviction is use those moments of failure or disappointment in an athlete's career, whether it's on a race or a workout or what have you, use them as a motivational point rather than this big drama anxiety, pouty point. And that happens a lot. People do all this hard work and they want to see payoff for their efforts. And we had a good example of this with like the men's cross country team. You know, these five individuals who are coming together collectively as one unit is fun to see here at Portland State. But they all ran, a week or two ago, career bests for themselves for cross country 8,000 meter, 100%, right? It was, always fun when you can point to that as a coach and say, hey, my whole team PR'd, right? But the competitive outcome wasn't at the level collectively and individually any of them aspired to. And so it was like, oh, great, we PR'd, but we're definitely disappointed and not satisfied. That's a great learning moment and opportunity to just reinforce what you're preaching, saying, hey, it's not about you've done all these 6 weeks of good workouts or 3 weeks of good workouts. Like, yeah, we got that accelerated development because of this small little chunk of time. You've been super consistent in putting in this type of work. But in order to go where you want to go, that's what I just talk about all the time now. We got to stack it days in and days out, weeks in and weeks out, months in and months out. Be steady with this approach and you'll be surprised what will happen 6 months down the road. But that's always a delicate moment for athletes' conviction and drive because you do a calculus, right? It's very real. You say, I did all this work and energy. I got better, but it's still not as good as I want to be. And that's pretty humbling when you come to the realization in competitive arenas that your best still isn't good enough. And that's the decision moment, right? That's the time to kind of double down, the time to really, really say, how much do I want this? And am I willing to keep doing this without immediate gains happening within a couple weeks? Am I willing to put and fork over a couple months of time? And when that happens, that's the decision-making process. That's the choice moment that we aspire to for athletes. So it's also just being aware that disappointment and failure events are rich in prime learning tools and opportunities that if you capitalize on them immediately in the right context, you can really, again, keep that inspiration going and that conviction and drive thriving and add essentially another log to the fire versus the disappointment that happens and then, all right, I'm going to run the next hard workout or workout really, really hard because I'm so pissed off with this poor result and, having kind of more of that newspaper or gasoline dumped onto the fire, which is, yeah, you had a great one workout, but now it's like the motivation or the outcome isn't sustained because you just killed yourself out of frustration over the session without actually getting better week in and week out. And I've seen that happen too. So as a coach, it's a very important time to intervene and, help the athletes see clearly and make the better decision.
I was reading a study the other day that got at this perfectly, which they were looking at youth sport dropout.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the number one drivers was fear of failure instilled by coach or parent. Which, when does that occur? When you fail and you handle it poorly. And as John just perfectly illustrated there is you can either put the fire out or you can stoke it with some good stuff that's going to sustain it over the long haul. So I think that's one of the things, whether coaches, parents, whoever, that we can really screw up. And it's understandable, after a tough loss or what have you, we're really emotional. And often we put that emotion on the athletes in a negative light, which blunts that fire instead of using it as that opportunity to really kind of stoke some positive motivation out of it.
Yeah. And the quote I'm coming back to a lot right now is success isn't final, failure isn't fatal, right? And it's the courage to continue that counts from Winston Churchill, right? And you see this in even Kobe Bryant, who, if you see motivational videos on him or reels going around on the social media platforms, he talks about win or lose, right? No matter what, we all have to wake up the next day and do the journey all over again. And I think people don't understand, it's this lack of permanence about your context and situation, the agency you have to change your competitive outcome and your approach, which is open to athletes and coaches at literally any time. You know, we talk about this a lot, Mike Smith and I, about every year NAU is a different team because it's different players, different teammates, different people, different athletes who have grown, right? It's not always the same exact faces. They'll lose some, you know, athletes, they'll gain some athletes, what have you. So it's not like, oh, NAU's this team that's just really good. You know, we get used to seeing that logo, right, atop the standings and rankings and finishes, like with the Golden State Warriors dynasty that was happening in the mid-2010s, the Chicago Bulls dynasty back in the 1990s, if you're looking into basketball, right, or the New England Patriots. We just get used to like, oh, this logo represents this, but it's actually the people who make up and who are a part of that collective team environment and cohesive environment that sustain that logo, right? And that logo is quote unquote dominant. So don't be fooled by the logo, and don't be fooled that just because this team won this year that they're going to win next year and all the years to come. It's not what it is. Our lifeblood, right, if any collective environment, is people. And it's how these people think, how they act, and how they respond to not only success, but also adversity and failure, which is the defining characteristic of people who have drive. And that's my encouragement to every listener, is to understand, like, every moment you have is either a moment for reinforcing and improving your conviction and drive, or a moment for it to erode. And it's just understanding it's so delicate in the beginning, because a lot of people will be on board and work hard as long as the success is coming and nonstop and easy to them. And then once they get to that threshold where the PRs aren't, you know, coming as easy and as quickly, or the wins aren't, you know, as populous as they once were, maybe at lower levels of competition for them, then people start to question why they're doing what they're doing, because they're not getting really frequent external positive feedback and engagement. And that's where the internal conviction becomes paramount. And we really have to do that work to understand it's a long road, it's a long journey. And every day we have another opportunity to kind of advance ourselves down that path. And it may not look like progress in the moment. It may look like, you know, a kind of sideways step or a little bit of a seesaw or a back step. But at the end of the day, it's about just stacking as many of those days together as you can. And when they start to add up, that's when big, big, big things happen. And I'll give a real quick example of this from my own personal history, is, you know, figuring out how to become a straight A high school student. And there was no map, no one gave it to me, but I understood that I also want to be a student athlete. So I don't have a lot of time. You're in class and then you're playing sport, and you're playing sport year round, you know, not very dissimilar to what we find in this day and age with a lot of high school student athletes. But I also knew I wanted to achieve a 4.0. So I said, okay, how am I tactically going to do this? And I realized I had an hour a day with lunch built in, that was free. That was free money, free time. So rather than go off campus every day for 4 years and go eat at the local Taco Bell and, you know, or Burger King and socialize with, you know, my friends, because I would socialize with them in class or at practice or through the context of sport, I went to the library, practiced, you know, brown bag every day for 4 years. And you do the math on that, right? It's like, all right, an hour a day times 5 days in a week, that's five extra hours. Then you do the math on that and you say, okay, five extra hours times 4 weeks, that's 20 extra hours, times 9 months, that's 180 extra hours, times 4 years. And all of a sudden now you have 720 study hours in front of you. That created that space to allow me to get a lot of the busy work or homework done, or, like, you know, do some like review for tests or something, because I knew I had that midday hour built in to be on top of my academic game. Then when I went to college, I didn't have that type of structure. And at first, it was very difficult for me to recreate it on my own because the schedule was so, had a lot more variability. And I struggled my first 2 years with that. And then I realized I came back to that practice my junior, senior year and got all A's again, right? Finally, able to manage being a Division I athlete at the Ivy level, having to graduate, like, you know, in 4 years and all that stuff that comes with that realm and arena. But it was the backsliding and then return to just that stability of practice of making that time where it's like mandated no matter what, I carved out this block to do this on a really consistent basis. And then it added up and it achieved the outcome. It's like, bringing that full circle here now as a head coach and helping mentor and teach younger coaches on my staff, you know, how to recruit. It's having a conversation like, oh, it's hard. I just need more time, this and that. I go, hey, man, that's BS. We all have 24 hours in the day. And I said, look, all you need to do is just call 15 people every week. If you call 15 people every week, and let's say for the remainder of the year, I'm recording this in mid-October, you have 10 weeks left in the year. That's 150 people, coaches or athletes you have talked to. And out of the 150 people, even if we only get like 5% to come, that's still seven recruits. And so that's the type of work. And it doesn't need to be pretty. It doesn't need to be sexy. It's just do the work to, you know, make contact, get a phone number, get engagement, and talk to 15 people. But if you just do it week in and week out, it adds up in a big way. And I think sometimes we underestimate that type of drive and conviction to be that consistent and steady as actually a hallmark and a key contributor to ultimately competitive and life success.
I couldn't have described it better, John. I think that's spot on. And I love the example of just using the small times and pieces to be able to foster that motivation. I think the same applies to our team. So, I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope that listeners did too. Drive and motivation are some of the central foundations. So make sure you're giving yourself time and thinking through this and having your athletes go through their personal inventory and even do that for yourself as a coach. So thanks everybody for listening. Check out the Scholar Program and keep on coaching and best of luck in everything you guys are doing. Keep listening.